This is Kate Harness with 3A7net Radio, and today I'm joined again by Superintendent Charles Oskey of Johnson County School District Number 1. Hello, Charles. Nice to see you.
Good morning. Good to see you, and I'm glad to be back on the air with you.
Lovely. Thank you for your time. Always appreciate it. So, outside, it's a beautiful morning this morning. Lovely, crisp, clear, sunny, if slightly chilly winter day, but yesterday morning was not so, and we had a late start for school. Can you just explain how that worked?
Absolutely. So I'm going to, with the crisp, yes, I don't do well with the crisp, but at the processes we go through. Yeah, we start, just as a reminder, usually transportation and facilities myself start about 3:30 in the morning, start having conversations, doing research prior to
so
that.
So how do you get notified? Because you don't wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and think, oh.
No, we usually start the day before, so that's a great question. Mm-hmm. So typically, we look 3 or 4 days in advance. I'll ask John what he thinks of the weather. I'll ask Bill what he thinks of the weather. Do we need to communicate in the morning? And typically, we'll say, well, if we think, we'll just get up and see where we're at and we'll communicate. So it really does start the day before. So a great example of that last night going on about 7:30, I called Bill, said, are we talking in the morning? He says, I don't think we need to. We're good. So,
And Bill is Bill McKenzie.
Yeah, so Bill McKenzie, our transportation director. So that's a great point. We usually start the night before where we're at. If the weather's really socked in, we'll maybe make a decision the night before, but 95% of the time we do it that morning. And we do resources. So Bill will drive, he'll look at the National Weather Service, he'll use his resources, I'll do that. A lot of times I'll call the National Weather Service. Also, I also get on text messages with superintendents around us. So we're all texting kind of what they're seeing in their different areas. And then we try to make a call. Typically, we try to make the call by 5 o'clock or earlier because we do have buses that leave. You have food service who has to prep for food. So there's just a lot of mechanisms that actually are in motion before anybody even gets up. So I know there's some concerns on why we get such early text messages, but sometimes that's to prevent the people from coming in or just preparing people. Yesterday was an exception to the rule because at 4 o'clock it was like, looks like we can get through this. The wind's going to pick up. It'll be howling. We're going to get a little bit of snow, but we ended up with more snow. So phone started ringing about 5:30 saying, hey, it's worse than we thought. So by 6, things were starting to shut down. Visibility was zero. So then we just said, hey, we're going to let the sun come out. We're going to give people a little extra time. And so we did a 1 hour delay, which is usually later than we typically do. But again, that's just kind of the communication, which is exciting, that happens between transportation facilities and myself and several other people. There was another neighboring district and the same thing. Made the call the exact same time I did. At 4 o'clock, we were good. At 6 o'clock, we weren't. So we're making calls. So that process kind of extends through. It was unique because typically it's either a 2 hour delay or no school. So there was a lot of questions on why just 1 hour. Well, in this case, it had to do with just basically allowing the sun to come out. We knew the wind was going to blow, but the visibility was going to increase tremendously just with the sun coming out. So that's why we did the 1 hour delay and then allow parents and everybody just to give that little extra time with the wind and visibility to get to school and just provide everybody to be safe, because that was the only one thing we dealt with. Most time with winter storms, we're dealing with road conditions, we're dealing with lots of snow and visibility and temperatures. So it was really just visibility and the crispness of the fresh air that, at 20 below, just giving people an opportunity to get there. So
it was really not so much about temperature, it was just wind and visibility yesterday. It was a very squally morning for anybody who wasn't
Absolutely. It was about the visibility. And then by the time, I was driving around town, within 30 minutes, it was cleared up. I felt it was a good call. I know it's a 50-50 chance whether we make people happy or not, but yesterday's scenario worked out well, which I'm grateful for. The previous weekend was just about the severeness of the wind chill.
So I wanted to ask you about that too, because virtually I think every single activity where there could have been a bus going somewhere with Johnson County school students in it was cancelled.
Yep.
I don't know how many of those events still took place around the state, but what was the reason behind that?
Well, we start looking at things. So the factor we look around is anything over negative 32 wind chill factor turns into frostbite after 10 minutes. A bus is going to cool down longer than that. I mean, most people, when you're in that kind of negative wind chill, you know, they freeze by the time they walk from their car to their house. I mean, it's just cold. So, 20 years ago, buses and they traveled and stuff like that, which was probably not to the best of knowledge, but the buses are different now. We also have DEF systems. We have all these emission systems that freeze up and they go into. So you have to take a lot of things into consideration. But the reality for me is when you start talking 10-minute frostbite time and things of that nature, that's something that Transportation Department and myself talk about with buses. A key point also is we want to keep, if we're transporting and we have to transport, we want it to be in the daylight. So all of those key factors go into that. And is it a necessity? Then we take that into consideration. But if it's really not, we don't want to endanger kids. Now, obviously, some people chose to continue, but some buses froze up. We dealt with some buses from other districts that were on the road. Kids had to spend extra nights. There were lots of people that couldn't get to work. Just got to keep all those parameters into consideration. But yeah, we did. We were actually the second district to pull the plug with all the activities. There were a couple others that continued, but they canceled by the next day. It was very limited. But the key factor for me in having this discussion is when you get wind chills that are greater than negative 32 degrees for any extended period of time, we really don't need to have kids on the bus. So we identify some of those type of things. So. Okay.
Well, thank you for explaining that. I'm sure that there's always a proportion of people who are very happy to get the call, and then there's another proportion who are like, oh, I've been interrupted or woken up or something.
Yeah.
So it's difficult.
And an extension of that, I mean, we canceled all activities, but if you don't mind, I want to go into, it's not just about buses, it's facilities. So facilities guys have to keep the buildings up and running. So we want to keep them closed up as much as we can. That type of heat, we were very, very fortunate. Our facilities team did a great job. He cranked the heat up. We want to limit the amount of new air coming in. We did lose one boiler, but there are a lot of districts that lost a lot of things because pipes froze and things of that nature. So not only do they have their homes to keep and their families to keep safe from freezing up, keeping these buildings and, you know, limiting the amount of potential issues and monitoring the buildings are also very critical. So when they're doing all that and all of a sudden you're plowing snow or you're doing removal to have events, I mean, sometimes it's a limited manpower too, even when we're doing the events here. So it's not just the buses, but when we talk about we're not going to have activities in the building, we're going to cancel them, part of that is because we want to keep our focus is going to be keeping on the buildings up and running, the monitoring of it, and those guys' time can't be split doing other things. So again, it's not just transportation, it's making sure that your facilities team is capable of keeping up even when we're doing home events.
So some of that must have a knock-on impact on expenditures and budget and so on. Does that cause headaches from a financial point of view as well?
Body language is yes, and the verbiage will be yes. So, your electricity bills go up, your gas bills go up. Typically, you're on a system that, you know, kind of tries to take the heat down in the buildings during the evening and then ramp it up before kids get there. We go to a 24/7. We don't ramp things down. We want to keep things at a certain temperature so we don't freeze pipes. So, we ramp the cost up. So that cost of keeping business, keeping the buildings maintainable, especially in wind. High winds pulls a lot of heat out of a building, so that cost does go up significantly in these winter months, and so that manpower to do that. But that cost is pretty minimal if you were to have frozen pipes and broken things. So, you know, the cost, we're just kind of outweighing that cost of what you have to do to fix or downtime piece of that. So.
So thank you, and that leads me to my next question, which is really, many people have been looking at budgets. We've got a legislative session coming up in just a few weeks' time, which is looking at budgets and expenditures and so on, and there are many people who say education gets way too much. There's way too much money in education. Do you have any remarks or comments you would like to make about that?
Education is the future of our society. So education is a number one priority. And I know there's a cost to that, but the cost of doing business has gone up in every aspect of things. But it is the future. It is our kids. So I always will be that advocate that and say that we're not spending too much in education. There's a certain level of expectation of what kind of education we provide. And when you set that level of expectation so high, there's a cost to that. So providing quality teachers, which is your number one resource, and how you fund those type of things. And Wyoming's different. We're very fortunate with the facilities we do have. There's a cost to that. But again, maintaining when there's a high level of expectations of what we should be teaching our kids, there's a cost that comes along with that. And that's a struggle that we're always going to hear, you know, and then we're saying we're not getting our bang for our buck. But on the other hand, I disagree. Even our state assessment itself is probably one of the tougher state assessments that there is in the nation. So, and again, we don't create that ourselves as a district. That's a statewide expectation of where we are. That's that accountability. That's that accreditation piece that, you know, we were so excited to get over with and we scored well with. But revenues are a concern here in Johnson County in budgeting. We are down students. Our ADM is down. So
ADM.
So that's our average daily membership, which is the number of students. I will refer, it's easier to say the number of students enrolled in school here in Johnson County. So we are in kind of that financial, really taking a look at that. We have some other challenges that with state laws that have changed in the last 18 months, revenue flow monthly has become something we are working on. Because that's been probably our biggest focus is making sure we can pay the bills on a monthly basis.
So would you not be able to pay your bills on a monthly basis? Could you explain that?
Yeah, great question. So we're entitled so much money. So so just as round figures, let's say Johnson County School District has around $20 million that we're, the state says that's what we have to operate on. Well, we don't get that $20 million all in one lump sum. We either get it through local taxes or we get it from the state through a partial entitlement payment. So how that comes in every monthly, and when we are as a district that a majority of our money comes from local taxes monthly, if we don't get the taxes we project on the monthly basis to pay bills, then we really, that's where our struggle of revenue comes every month is it's really based on did the projected, and let me have the key word, did all the taxes come in and did that get paid to the school district is where we are. So it's based on a very unpredictable cash flow right now. We're actually have averaged being down between 25 and 30% monthly compared to last year. And so then that means you have to resubmit the 100 to maybe get a little more money from the state. But the end game right now is just trying to get that monthly revenue to do our expenditures. So we've been really saying no to things. There are some things we can't say no to. So where do you find that revenue? But on the average, our monthly expenditures with salaries and benefits and everything to do to operate the district is around $2 million. So that's kind of where we're trying to stay in that window. Coming back to now, we've had some cold spells, okay? So, you know, electricity in some of our buildings can run between $12,000 and $15,000 a month. That's not because we chose to keep the lights on. That's just keeping the heaters running, keeping the lights on during the day. So anytime we extend beyond a normal school day, there's a cost to some of that. So those are all things we try to take into consideration.
I think some people may be surprised to hear that you don't just get, you know, your $20 million in a nice lump sum and you just chip away at it through the school year being accountable, that it's actually so, it's passed out to you in, you know, unpredictable chunks. Are there any changes planned to make that more manageable for you, perhaps?
Well, that's what we're working on. So you'll hear that loan that we got at the first part of the year because we knew we were going to have a revenue flow issue and we're trying to pay that $3.9 million back. Well, the payment was due in December while the state's working with us, so we're paying it back in chunks because our revenues are down. And it is, and like I said in the paper too, it's not that we're asking for more money than we're entitled to. It's just asking to keep the monthly bills and staying within our budgeted amount. But you still got to have the cash to do it because, like we just stated, the cash isn't in the bank. And you don't go in the red and you can't operate in the red, you know, unless you get a loan. So we really have to make sure we have the revenues to do that. And then there's other pockets of money within the district that you just can't use. So yeah, we have, you know, $3 million in our major maintenance account, but that is for facilities. You can't take major maintenance funds and pay for salaries. You can't.
And then pop it back in.
And then pop it back in. Okay. And so those are all those things. You have special ed money that has cables tied to cables tied to cables to it. So you can't be caught mismanaging your money. So there are some buckets that, hey, the school has a lot of money in that. But again, those buckets are specific and only can be spent in specific ways. So those are some challenges, not going down that, getting in the weeds that we'll be here for a couple hours trying to explain. It's just that the overall view is it's a cash revenue flow issue at this point. Actually, before you came in, we just got done meeting with another state leadership gentleman, and we're working with the Wyoming Department to potentially change some policies and hopefully even with some legislators, some rules. So districts, which like ours, need a different way to be supported, because the current statutes really don't support the situation that we're in. So it's exciting. We're also, instead of complaining about it, we're actually going to do something about it. And as Representative Crago said, the rules have changed in the last 2 years, so now it's time to adapt and change the policies, that really align to how we function now with revenues in school districts. So that's exciting. So we are, along with a couple other people, have already met with the state. We've asked to meet with them again. So this will impact hopefully all districts in our boat, which is exciting. So instead of complaining, we're doing something about it in a way that I think impacts educational revenue flows for the future to come. So hopefully
well, thank
that goes
you.
Through.
And while we're talking about funding, something close to parents' and students' hearts is the issue of funding activities and extracurricular activities.
Yes.
Is there enough money for that?
Well, there's always enough money in the pot. It's just how we divide it up. But how we're looking at that right now is we spend more than we're allocated according to the state funding model.
And is that just you're bending the rules or you're actually...
No, that's why it's a block grant. So we're doing the same thing with teachers. So there's some, there's a couple areas that, that's why there's a block grant. What is the need and where we're at? But if we really look at it, activities are about... $165 over what we're funded in the model. And we're not the only district that way. I mean, there's a lot of districts. So it comes back to a resource allocation, what are we doing with our strategic plan. But we are going to start having some hard conversations, because as our ADM has declined, that means all areas that we can spend money on have to take some type of hit. So activities is one. So we're doing it kind of... It's district-wide. And that activity piece is we've got a committee that's come together. We're going to meet with coaches. We're going to have a community meeting sometime this spring to kind of show where we are financially and then come up with a solution. And my solution is not to cut activities. Is we need to find additional revenue sources so we can currently support what we have. That means why I said currently have. Any addition of programs or sports at this point in time is a hard no until we can find other revenue sources that can support things long term. It's the same thing we're having conversations about how we can support our staff and our schools. I mean, the funding's just not down for activities. The funding is going to be down across everything that we do. So there are some challenges that we will have over the next 12 to 15 months. We're going to use ESSER funds, the final part of ESSER funds, to kind of mitigate that and give us some time to find some solutions. But I think right now, between where we are today with our student count to where we were in the 1920 school year, we're almost down probably about 130 kids. So that's a huge financial difference between what we receive.
So there'll be some people who say, well, you're down the number of kids, but you're also down the number of kids so that it's not costing you as much. But that equation isn't quite as simple as that, is it?
No, even if you just take 100 kids and you divide that among 13 grade levels, okay, you're only talking, at the most, maybe even if it was on the average, 5 or 6 kids per grade level, because you got kindergarten, you got through 12th grade, so you got 12.
And you've still 13. Got to put a teacher in front of them,
yes, and
put
classes.
Them in a building and get them to and from school, perhaps, and so on, and feed them, and all those overheads are fixed, regardless of how big or small your student population
is.
And
some of those things don't go away, like the cost of heating the building. It doesn't matter, we're down 100 kids. You still have to keep the buildings, the cost of electricity, the cost of gas, the cost of maintaining those buildings. All those things continue to skyrocket, the cost of insurance. I mean, so even though you're down, our class sizes doesn't mean that all of a sudden we got class sizes of 3. We still have some fairly large classes. It's just a matter of those 100 kids has an overall impact on the budget, and all these other things continue to go up. Benefits for employees, if you want to give steps and lanes, you know, the insurance, the cost of doing gas, the cost of heating your buildings to keep the lights on, the cost of curriculum, the cost of professional development. I mean, there isn't anything in our day-to-day operations that has typically gone down when we talk about some of those essentials, right?
I think, you know, anybody who, you know, is involved in their own home or family finances knows that nothing has gone down.
Yeah.
Everything seems to have just gone up and up and up and quite sharp levels, and obviously school districts are subject to that too.
And that's why we're excited that hopefully legislation will pass that external cost adjustment to kind of hopefully mitigate some of that again next year. So,
so going back to activities, our Johnson County School District is spending, as you say, 165% over the model. What is the expense? How are the expenses accrued through activities? How do they total up?
So just like anything else, you got salaries and benefits for coaches.
How much does a coach
and
make? How much do we pay coaches?
Travel. It's based on a scale. So it's a sliding scale with a little bit of a increase for every years of experience. So I don't want to misquote that. So
okay.
But when we compare to other districts where our coaches are districts our size, our coaches our salaries are very comparable to some other compatible ones. So
okay. So you've got the overhead for coaches actually delivering
and the fact is, I mean, I'll just be transparent, but what we receive in funding, we spend 100% of what we receive in funding goes to coaches. Actually, we spend more on salaries and benefits than we actually receive. So that extension of that extra is, you know, the referees' fees, the cost of putting on events. So a majority of what we receive goes to the salaries and benefits of the coaches we have.
So what sort of proportion do you happen to know of students are actually involved in some kind of extra activity of some sort?
Well, that's what's exciting is Johnson County has a lot of kids participating, so it's well over 80% of our kids participate in some activities. And so that's a great question. So in that concept, when people say, well, we have 80% of our kids participating, you're absolutely right, but because we have 80% compared to a large district that might only have 30%, we don't get more funding. So we should be excited. We should be ecstatic that our kids and our teachers and our coaches care, and we have those kind of participation going on with activities. But because we have 80%, doesn't mean that generates more money. It's just now we have more kids, and so where do we rob Peter to pay Paul to make sure that those events are taking place? And that's the struggle. Some of these districts that have only maybe 30 or 40%, their entire population helps generate the fees for activities, but only 30 or 40% of those kids are actually benefiting from those fees. Those are some things we have to remember too. So that balancing act, when you say, yeah, I am thrilled to know that our kids are in front of people who care and there's activities that are involved. But when that high number of kids are participating, what people have the misperception as well, that means we should get more funding from the state. That doesn't work that way. It's we should be excited how we choose to use the block grant to fund that, but there has to be some limitations. That's the challenge I think we see, not only with activities, but with other things, is where's the cap? How much can we actually funnel towards that? The reality is I can take a bucket of money and I can separate it any way we want. However, the more we separate, we can separate it 1,000 ways. There's $1,000. Everybody gets $1. Or we can separate it 100 ways. Everybody gets $10, however we want to do it. But the bucket of money doesn't increase. So that's where that resource allocation, working with the board and the strategic plan that we talked about last time, become a critical. Is where do we put our priorities? And when we say that, that's where we're going to put our money.
So you mentioned adding new activities is off the table for a while. But a review is going to happen to look at the funding, the activities that we currently have. Are you looking outside of the school district? Are we talking about, you know, getting parents to do fundraisers? What are the options?
So it might be regenerating the Booster Club. It might be working with the rec district and the rec mill of what that looks like, you know, taking a look at some of those type of things. Some districts are very fortunate. They have some foundations that help support some of that. So, and then again, how much do we say yes to? And some of that is looking for our efficiencies. I mean, not just seeking more money, but we also need to come to the drawing board and say, what efficiencies have we really done as a district and as in any program, whether it's activities. Great examples, what are we doing in technology? What are we doing in facilities? Where are we leveraging other funds? And I'll just use technology and facilities as an example. We reduced technology by 1 staff member, and to help mitigate some of that funding, we've joined back in and got to the E-rate. So there's some grants there. John was down a guy in maintenance, so we increased the general fund maintenance by adding another staff member. But now that mitigation is we're using major maintenance funds to make sure we're paying for everything that we can. So we just have to be creative with that pot of money. But finding that avenue is, you know, whether it's fundraisers through some type of booster club, whether it's working with the rec district. I mean, it's all the way down the list from pay to play. Do you have tryouts? I mean, there's lots of things that are on the table, but there's been no decisions that have been made. But we have to decide what that looks like for the future.
Well, thank you. I you know, this is something that we will keenly follow, and I look forward to kind of finding out a lot more about the conversations that are happening and the final direction that we end up going in. You mentioned the word efficiencies, and my question is, before we wrap up, what do you do as a school district to regularly be looking at for efficiencies in any expenditures? Do you have a standard protocol that you follow?
So when we look for efficiencies, each building is going to be challenged with where they're looking at their efficiencies. As a district level, when we print our monthly expenditure reports, okay, what's a trend there? And we have a great staff that, you know, kind of catches some things, will highlight some things. What we're buying now goes through a procurement process. So anything at a certain level, we sit down as a team, and the question is, this is a want or is it a need, okay?
And can you find it cheaper elsewhere? Is that part of the equation too?
Yeah, part of the question is, can we find it cheaper? But I'll tell you the other question that comes from me. Cheaper is not always better. So if we buy the cheap one and then we have to fix it every year, maybe we need to spend a little bit extra money because this product has demonstrated the last 15 years where the cheap one you're replacing every 3 or 4. So those are things we take into consideration too. But the other thing we look at is service. So when you're starting to buy some products that have to be serviced by other people, do we have people that will stand behind the service and service a long time? Because, you know, you can get a cheap product, but then once the product is yours, there's nobody to service it. So I love what we put into place the last couple of years. Is there's a team of people. We slow things down. It's actually the result of our federal investigation, our procurement policies, is how do we continue unifying? The other part is going to all one keyless entry system instead of having 4 or 5. It's trying to put the same cameras in. It's trying to put the same bell systems in. So some of those efficiencies is going to come by being more unified with the systems we offered. Same thing we're trying to do with software. Why are we buying expensive software that only 1 or 2 teachers want? Is it something district-wide? So looking at saying, this is the only software we'll support at the district level. If this is a program you want in your building, then you have to find it out of your building budget. So those are the types of efficiencies we're looking for also. So just becoming more strategic. does this one group have one Chromebook and this one has a set of laptops? So, you know the what the efficiencies say is we're moving toward everybody will have a Chromebook because those are easier to maintain and to replace. What is the importance of what that looks like? Keeping up with technology is tough, but technology, once you buy it, it has a lifespan. So we got to start looking at finding something that will last long enough that when you do replace it, it's done its job. And those are, I guess, the type of efficiencies that we look at from a district level.
Well, thank you very much indeed for this conversation today. It's clear to me that you have a lot going on. I'd better let you get back to it.
Thanks.
But thank you very much indeed for your time, and I look forward to catching up with you again next week.
Yeah, no, and I love these conversations. I hope I didn't muddy the water, but if I did, reach out, give me a call, and we'll talk to it in a little more detail. So,
thank you very much indeed.
All right.